Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. So thank you very much, Will, for joining me today on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So you're on the other side of the world. We've spent a little bit of time trying to coordinate this interview, and thank you for your patience. Maybe just for listeners at the beginning, can you just tell us a little bit about your background and your current work focus, Will?
Right. Well, my background is rather unusual. I've worked in very many areas of what might broadly be called environmental science, from environmental physics through to climate change. And now really what I would call myself would be an earth system scientist. So basically, there are a group of us who are trying to understand how the earth operates as a single integrated system, how the system is changing, and in particular, of course, how human activities are becoming the dominant force of driving change in the earth system. So I've been in this area for about 25 or 30 years, worked mainly internationally. I was director of a big international program with the name International Geosphere Biosphere Program for about 7 years, and have continued collaboration with colleagues in Europe, North America, and indeed other parts of the world.
Right, right. So you've been up close on some of the dramatic environmental changes that have been taking place in recent decades and building up, accelerating over time. Just wondering, clearly there's no shortage of environmental problems we're facing, and now we have the coronavirus, which is not unrelated either. But I'm just wondering, what in particular, is there anything that keeps you awake at the moment?
Yeah, well, it's some work that we published about a year and a half ago, but we've been working on this idea of tipping points in the Earth system for quite a while. That is, those are parts of the Earth system that you can push or perturb for a while, and they look to be stable, and you just cross a tipping point and the entire system can flip. A good analogy is if you're out on a lake on a kayak and you tip the kayak a bit and it comes back to a nice stable position and you go on your merry way. But if you tip it just a bit too much, it flips all the way over. There's no intermediate state and you're under the water and in a bit of strife. And we find that there are quite a few parts of the Earth system that actually show this behavior, that they look to be stable until you push them past a critical point and then they can tip and go into another state. Well, recently a number of us started looking at this issue of tipping points more systematically, trying to map out what are the critical tipping points. And basically we're looking at things like big ice sheets, like the Greenland ice sheet, the Antarctic ice sheets. We're looking at ocean circulation, like the so-called Gulf Stream, or more properly the North Atlantic thermohaline circulation. And we were looking at big biomes or ecosystems like the Amazon rainforest. And most of these, if you look at their behavior in the distant past up to the present, they actually do show tipping point behavior. But I think the breakthrough we made a couple of years ago was to look at these as an interlinked set of tipping points, not looking at them in isolation. And that brings up the idea of a tipping cascade. So there you can picture, say, a row of dominoes that are all set up in a line, and you start tipping the first couple and it knocks the whole row down. So the concern there is that if we start triggering some of these tipping points, they will form a planetary tipping cascade, and they will in fact take the Earth system out of human influence or human control. And we would go to a very different state of the system, one that we dubbed Hothouse Earth in the paper. And it would be very hard for humans to thrive in. So that's what keeps me awake at night. That's what I worry about, is that the Earth can be an angry beast when you poke it with a big stick. And we are definitely hitting it with a big stick at the moment. And it could get out of our control and go into conditions, into states that are going to be very deleterious for human well-being.
So how does it change things that these tipping elements are actually interlinked?
Well, what that means is that we could face what we call a tipping cascade or a state change in the Earth system as a whole. So let me give you an example of what how some of these tipping elements might interact with each other. And we'll start up in the northern hemisphere, up in the northern high latitudes, where things are happening fast. For example, Arctic sea ice is melting at an increasing rate. And of course, that occurs during the northern hemisphere summertime. When that happens, as the sea ice retreats, darker ocean water is uncovered. And of course, that absorbs more sunlight. That accelerates the heating in that region. That accelerates the loss of ice. And that pushes the heat, the temperature even higher. So you see this feedback effect. But of course, sitting right next to the Arctic Ocean is the Greenland ice sheet. And as the feedback from the melting Arctic sea ice intensifies, it also increases the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. The Greenland ice sheet is mainly melting from on top, so it's increasingly discharging fresh water onto the North Atlantic Ocean, which sits on the surface of the ocean. This, in turn, is affecting the North Atlantic Ocean circulation. In fact, we can already measure a slowdown over the last half century of that circulation. That slowdown, in turn, is reducing rainfall over the Amazon basin down in Brazil, which is making it more vulnerable to drought and fires, losing carbon to the atmosphere, which again accelerates the heating of the planet. So you can see this is how four of these different tipping elements are actually linked together. And we can pretty clearly make these links across other tipping elements too. So when these all start acting like a row of dominoes, one pushing the other, you can start to see how a global scale tipping cascade could occur, which would, in principle, shift the entire state of the Earth system to another state.
Right. Conceptually, I get that. In your research, do you have a sense of the magnitude of impact by looking at it, by taking into account the links between the different tipping elements?
Yeah. So what we can do is we can make some crude estimates of how much the various tipping elements can increase warming. And we can use, at least for many of them, global temperature as a metric, because many of them release carbon to the atmosphere or else absorb more sunlight like the Arctic Ocean and increase temperature. So a rough estimate now is that if we, through our own emissions, push temperature up to 2 degrees, we may add another half a degree or degree through these tipping elements, depending on how severe the tipping cascade could be. And of course, that in turn would take the temperature up to 2.5 and 3, which may trigger more tipping elements like melting permafrost or the methane hydrates, which are locked in the sediments under the Arctic Ocean. And if that happens, then the temperature goes even higher. So I think in a worst case scenario, what you could see would be that a 2 degree temperature rise driven by human emissions could trigger further warming up to a total of 3 or 4 degrees Celsius, which would be a much hotter state than humans have ever experienced before. So that's really the danger of this tipping cascade, is it could, in effect, take the trajectory of the Earth system out of our control and push it to a hotter state, even if we got emissions under control.
That's terrifying. To what extent do the forecasts and the IPCC and other models that have been developed take into account these considerations, Will?
They're beginning to do that through what they call large-scale singular events and large-scale discontinuities. So when you look at the special report on the 1.5-degree Paris target, many of these were actually assessed by the IPCC. And they found that at 1 degree of warming where we are today, there's a moderate risk that we're going to start destabilizing some of these, and we can actually see true. When you get up to 2.5, which is far as that IPCC report went, they're talking now about a moderate to high risk that we could start many of these tipping points. So yes, they are being assessed, and the initial assessment, we'll get more obviously in the AR6 when it comes out next year, is certainly suggesting that when you get up toward 2 degrees, you have a significant risk that you are going to destabilize several of these tipping elements.
Right. not good news at all. Are there one or two tipping elements that you think we should pay attention? I mean, clearly all of them, but that are more crucial, that maybe more linked to other tipping elements. Are there one or two that you'd point to?
Well, I would point to three. I think the Arctic sea ice is a critical one because I think we're close to that tipping point. Some people say we may have actually crossed it. I think West Antarctica is also extremely vulnerable. We're seeing a lot of activity down there in terms of destabilization of ice sheets down there. That could add eventually 3 meters to sea level rise. But the third one I would really nominate as being very important is the North Atlantic ocean circulation. And the reason I say that is linked to so many different tipping points that it acts as a real connector and one that could start accelerating other tipping points as well. So I would argue that we really need to keep a close watch on what's happening in the North Atlantic. I think that's going to be a crucial part of the entire Earth system.
Right. That's a very dark prospect. You talk about tipping points. I guess point systems can tip in different ways. Is it necessarily a negative thing? Are there some systems that you look at? Or are there some systems in the Earth system that could tip in a positive way? And I'm also interested, maybe biting off more than I can chew here, in terms of the interaction between the Earth system and social systems, because clearly that's a very important connection in the sense that, you know, that the kind of behaviors and the group behaviors and mass behaviors that are taking place at the moment and how we change those is terribly important.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And in fact, we view the social systems and humans, we are part of the Earth system. So the way we define the Earth system is not just the biophysical Earth system. It's the entire Earth system, which includes us humans, our technologies, our societies, and so on. I mean, we evolved on the Earth from primates, so we are indeed part of the Earth system. We've obviously developed now powerful technologies. We've developed very complex social systems and so on. So, but we are part of the Earth system. In fact, if you want to look at a sort of a very high-level composition of the Earth system, would be of three great spheres that are all interacting. One is the geosphere, the non-living part of the Earth system, and that has to do with things like the ice, like the physical climate system, like the rocks and so on. And then the living part of the Earth system, of course, which distinguishes Earth from other planets, the so-called biosphere, plants, animals, bacteria, all the way up to humans. And then, of course, now we have what some call the anthroposphere or some call the technosphere. And that's the advanced human society, civilizations, which have now become the dominant driver of change. But that's sort of a by way of background, to get to your point of can there be positive tipping points? And the answer is yes, and they probably lie in the social, in the anthroposphere. And we're talking increasingly about the way we deal with things like climate change, biodiversity degradation, and so on, is not via gradual change in human societies or in governance systems or in economic systems. It's by crossing tipping points that can lead to rapid and decisive change with how we do things. A good example of that, of course, is the COVID-19 crisis, where that has already caused one tipping point in terms of a lot of things that we sort of held as sacrosanct, like the new neoliberal economic system, and all that got turned on their head in a matter of weeks when we started dealing with this virus. And that's opened up a lot of discussion now about when we do come out of the COVID-19 crisis, out of the pandemic, what sort of society will we have? Will we go back to the society we had pre-pandemic, which was high growth rate, high consumption, huge rates of pollution, both locally all the way to globally? Or will we actually transform ourselves? In other words, will we cross a tipping point towards a much more sustainable society? Now, nobody knows the answer to that question, of course, but that would be a good example of a potential very positive tipping point, and it would happen in the anthroposphere part of the Earth system.
Well, very interesting, and I'm just wondering the topology, the Anthropocene. Have you thought about calling it the Capitalocene? and the degree to which the last 30 years or 40 years, the vast amount of the carbon emissions have taken place during that time, with a pretty wide runaway kind of phase of economic growth with deregulation and so forth. And somehow, when people talk about the Anthropocene, it kind of puts a lens on humans, as it were, as they've evolved. But looking at the capital scene, maybe more helpful in terms of looking at a particular set of political and economic values and processes at a particular time. And that is, in a sense, more manageable. If you want to change, looking at changing human nature, the humans have overtaken the planet and destroyed it, or put in place more progressive political and economic policies.
Yeah, no, that's that idea of the capitalist scene has been floated quite a bit. In fact, there are quite a few different names for this new geological time interval. Another one you hear about is the Manthropocene, referring to the fact that it's mainly males who have been driving this destructive economic system, not women. So that's another one. There are other variations out there, too, that I've seen. Of course, the term Anthropocene came from a meeting that we had within the IGBP in the year 2000. And it came from Paul Crutzen, who's a noted atmospheric chemist. In fact, he's a Nobel laureate for his work on the ozone hole. But Paul's one of the most outstanding Earth system scientists of all of us. And he was the one who was astute enough, when he was simply looking at the observations of what was happening to the planet. This was in the year 2000, and we were looking at these very sharp curves of changes in human activity. And at that time, we hadn't split it between developed and developing countries, between the OECD countries or the Anglophone countries, or any sort of splitting you want to do. We were just looking at humans as a species in the Earth system. And when we saw all the changes to the Earth system itself, to the biosphere, to the geosphere, and how tightly they correlated with changes in human societies, it became pretty obvious that there was a strong cause effect here. And that's when Paul, who made that connection there, uttered out the word, we're not in the Holocene anymore, we're in the Anthropocene. Having said that, I think you raise a good point in that the word Anthropocene is an all-encompassing umbrella term that hides a lot of rich detail in human societies, and particularly the inequality issue. And that's, of course, when you use the word capitalocene, that immediately tells you that there is that we're going to start dealing with some pretty strong inequalities. So I think in terms of the natural sciences and in terms of the geological sciences, which are now undergoing the process of formalizing the Anthropocene in the geological timescale, I think Anthropocene is an appropriate term. But I think once we start talking, digging into the Anthropocene, then I think all sorts of other ideas, all sorts of other terms certainly can be enlightening. So I think that just having the Anthropocene out there in the first place is really triggering an extremely rich and important discussion amongst the social sciences and humanities scholars about what really is the Anthropocene, who's responsible, why are we in the situation we are, where are we going? What do we need to do to change this? And all of those are extremely important questions. So I hope that the overarching term that Paul came up with 2 decades ago now is hopefully still is serving a useful purpose in terms of triggering such discussions and debates.
Yes, absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about the time frame in which you did the research? You've been looking at the tipping points and so forth, and also the time frame in which we need to consider when we're dealing with carbon emissions and so forth. How long the carbon CO2 remains in the atmosphere? How long it takes to reduce that, or how long it takes before our actions today we can expect to have an impact on levels of carbon emissions, and then thereafter the climate?
Yeah, those are some really good questions. So let me start by talking about this notion that started with the students, with Greta Thunberg and her movement, the fact that we are now in a climate emergency. Now, that immediately tells you something about a time scale, saying that the problem is immediate. There is no more time to lose. We are in trouble. And I think there's good scientific evidence that the students are right. And a good way of looking at it is looking at two concepts. One is called reaction time, and the other is called time for intervention. Now, what do I mean by that? Let's take a tipping point or tipping element, and let's take the Greenland ice sheet, for example. Now, to stabilize that ice sheet so it will not cross a tipping point where the melting becomes irreversible and unstoppable, and we are destined to lose enough ice to raise seas about 7 meters. So we don't know where that tipping point lies. When you lose enough ice that it's lowered far enough, the surface of that ice sheet, that it's in a warmer climate and it melts even more, and you can see the feedback mechanism at work there. Let's just say, for example, that that tipping point is on present trajectories 20 to 25 years into the future. But countries are talking about finally getting climate change slowed and perhaps stabilized by reaching net zero emissions by 2050. That's 30 years away. So that would be a measure of our reaction time. So if the time for intervening is shorter than the reaction time, then you are committed to crossing the tipping point, which we may already be in terms of Greenland. So that's how you can define that we are in an emergency situation. A good example might be that the Titanic is that it takes a while to stop or turn around a ship. And if you notice that you are heading for an iceberg and your reaction time is longer than the time to intervene that you have left, you're going to strike the iceberg. And we know what happened to the Titanic. So you need to be able to react far enough in advance to stop crossing these tipping points. So let's just take the number that a lot of countries are talking about, net zero by 2050, and let's say that our reaction time then is 30 years. Actually, it's a little bit longer because it takes the climate a bit longer to stabilize after we get emissions net zero. Anyway, let's take 30 years. Then let's look at some tipping points. What about Arctic sea ice? That's the floating ice on top of the Arctic Ocean. Some people think we've already crossed that tipping point. If not, we will cross it probably in the next 5 to 10 years. So that's probably gone. West Antarctica, again, that could be a 5 to 10 year intervention time left, which means that's going to go. The Great Barrier Reef, or coral reefs in general, we've had 3 mass bleaching events in 5 years on the Great Barrier Reef. The last one has just now occurred. And it's the first one that bleached the entire reef north to south. The intervention time there is probably zero. So that means we are already crossing the tipping point there. So you can do that analysis. And it tells you that net zero by 2050 is exceptionally dangerous. There is a high risk that we will start this tipping cascade, which will then become irreversible. To put it in more IPCC-like framework, net zero by 2050 will put us in a 2 to 2.5 degree world. And the special report on the 1.5 degree temperature rise actually did assess the risk of tipping points as being high at 2.5 degrees. So all of this science is telling us that if we don't get emissions down much faster than we're planning, and if we don't come very close to hitting that 1.5 degree target, we may already be in deep trouble as far as a tipping cascade. So when you work backwards, if you want to meet the Paris target of 1.5 or have a chance, that means you need to cut emissions by half by 2030. That's one decade. And you need to get to net zero by about 2040. That means working backwards that every year now matters. This is the definition of a climate emergency. So this is a good way, I think, of how you can use timeframes, timescales, to say something that appears to be a long-term problem. Well, all right, if we don't get emissions down now, 2025, 2030, when the technology is cheaper, we can do it then. Well, sorry, that's almost surely going to be too late. So this whole idea of timescales, it's a subtle issue, it's a complex issue, but it's one that needs to be talked about much, much more because we're headed for a Titanic-like outcome if we don't start steering and slowing the ship from now.
Very interesting, if terrifying. Well, what's your view on cutting emissions? And I don't know who it is who said, but somebody said this, or might as well, that whenever climate change policies are seen to conflict economic growth and development, climate change loses every time. And maybe that's apropos, particularly in Australia. Maybe if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that's in striking contrast to the COVID-19 crisis, where suddenly we can shut down economies, we can stop all sorts of things if we have to protect human life. So it's, again, this is the timing issue we're talking about, that the COVID crisis is immediate. It's in our faces. You know, people are dying now. We can see that this is an issue we have to deal with. Climate change is sort of a long fuse, big bang problem. It's not immediate, but it's actually far more dangerous than the COVID-19 crisis. So I think we really see the difference. And as you said, when it comes to these longer term problems, the climate loses out almost every time. Australia is a good example of this. In fact, we're in a very unusual place because compared to most other developed countries, we are getting clobbered more directly and more severely by climate change than most others. I've talked about the Great Barrier Reef. Everyone knows about the serious bushfires we've just come through during this past summer. There are all sorts of other things happening, severe droughts, exceptional rainfall. All these things are happening. The science is absolutely clear. Climate change is playing a strong, even dominant influence in a lot of these. But at the same time, our economy is strongly driven by the resource sector. And the resource sector has two of the big three fossil fuels, coal and gas. And despite all the evidence, despite the opinion polls that are increasingly saying people want meaningful action on climate change, we get none. And the reason for that, in my view, is a corrupted political economic system where the big end of town, the fossil fuel industries, are basically buying out the government through donations, all sorts of other things. So our present conservative government is quite happy to take the appropriate hard action on COVID-19, but at the same time, ignoring the longer term, even bigger threat of climate change and continuing not only to support, but to expand the fossil fuel industry, while at the same time, Australia burns, the Great Barrier Reef dies, people suffer, ecosystems are getting battered, and yet we continue on. So it's a real paradox that we can deal with something like COVID-19 quickly and decisively, but we cannot, so far we have not been able to prove that we can get on top and deal with the climate change issue.
Yes, it's very interesting. So how do we cut emissions? I mean, a big question, it operates at many different levels. Talked about the government level and the policy level, working with the IPCC framework and so forth. I know some people I've interviewed have been quite critical of that framework. And that kind of approach. How do you see the governance, as it were? Is this something that you've looked at, or do you think this is important?
Oh, absolutely, because there's a sort of discussion and debate between what can I do as an individual? For example, I can fly less, I can use less electricity, I can put solar panels on my roof, all this sort of stuff. That's actually good, and you'll feel good about that. But we're not going to solve this unless we take collective action, because this is ultimately a collective action problem. And large-scale collective action problem, and that's where governance becomes really important. There are some bright spots in the Australian story here too, and that's the sub-national level where some strong action is being taken. The two leading jurisdictions are the state of South Australia, which has well over 50% renewable already. It's dropping its emissions, and it's doing quite well economically. And the other one is where I live, which is the Australian Capital Territory, encompassing the city of Canberra, a small jurisdiction, approaching 500,000 people. But we have already cut our emissions by well over 50% on 2005 levels. In fact, it's 40% on 1990 levels, which were much lower than 2005. How did we do it? We saw that the low-hanging fruit was going 100% renewable. So in the space of 9 years, from 2011 to 2020, we have gone from a tiny fraction of our electricity being renewable to 100%. And that's a mix of solar PV, industrial scale, and wind farms. And what we did was we used a reverse auction process by the ACT government, putting out a bid saying, we want X megawatt capacity of electricity, and various companies can bid to supply us with that, and the lowest bid gets the project. But it has to be a zero carbon source. And in practice, in 2011, there were only two technologies which were on the market then, and that was solar PV and wind. And we went through that reverse auction process a bit at a time, and we rode the cost curve down. So as that decade went on, the cost dropped dramatically, and we were getting electricity at cheaper and cheaper costs, to the point now where we are 100% renewable, and we have some of the lowest electricity prices in Australia. Now, we talked about tipping points. That was a tipping point, because that was fought quite hard way. A lot of the economists within the government said, we can't possibly do this. This will break the territory. We have to stick with the tried and true cheaper fossil fuels. But fortunately, to give them credit, the government said, no, we are going to take this on and do it. But that's now I think, created a tipping point that we've crossed. Now that we're 100% renewable, we want to get the other 60% out. Emissions out of our economy, which is transport, built infrastructure, heating, cooling, waste, and so on. And so now we've legislated to do that by 2045. We're on our way to decarbonizing the transport sector and so on. And now we have really widespread support. So I think we crossed a social tipping point in Canberra, and now the entire community is behind the push to get us totally net zero by 2045. When you look at the carbon budget is accompanying that emission reduction curve, we would be at about a 1.7 to 1.8 degree temperature rise if everyone else followed the Canberra model. So it does show that you can meet the Paris targets, but it actually requires transformative, decisive action that really fundamentally changes not only technologies, but societies as well. So that's the challenge we face.
Yes, that's very impressive. Very impressive. Will, now, an earlier interview, I think you did maybe last year, I think it was in Auckland, and you were talking, I think, about very interesting for some of the issues you've touched on earlier, the Earth systems perspective. And what I guess you were, there was a kind of bifurcation, a kind of moment where we're going down one or two avenues, as it were, possibilities. And you said something here, we are in control of where the Earth is going. And I wondered what you meant by that, talking about steering the Earth to a stabilized Earth. I think that's what you're calling it. And I just wonder about thinking about it in those terms. I mean, clearly there are things we can do, but this question of agency and action and being able to, I just wondering if that's something that you, maybe just talk a little bit about that to begin with. And then
So that's the other side of the tipping cascade. So the tipping cascade I talked about earlier that takes you to hothouse Earth, as I mentioned, takes the Earth system out of human influence or control. In other words, the internal feedbacks in the system take over and become the dominant driver. So, but the other side of the fork in the road is this, what we call a stabilized Earth in our paper. And that's, we use the word steering, I think, steering the Earth system to a stable state that isn't quite like the Holocene, the state we've come out of, but it's something that might be manageable. But and that requires human action, but it's human action to reduce our pressure on the Earth system so that we don't cross these tipping points. So that means that we don't try to control your system. We don't try to geoengineer it. We, in fact, try to control ourselves because ourselves are the problem. And we generate different types of societies, different types of economies, different types of technologies that are all designed to take pressure off the Earth system, not to make wealthy people even wealthier. So that's really what the problem is there. There's some really good ideas out there on how one might do this. There's a wonderful concept called donut economics that Kate Raworth, who's an economist at Oxford, I believe, she's the creator of that. And it's I think it's a very powerful concept in that she looks at a donut where the inner ring is the social well-being that we want, more equality in terms of gender equality, income equality. We want higher quality of life, better education, all these things that create a better society. But at the same time, we have to live within the limits of the planet. And that's where the so-called planetary boundaries concept comes in, which is a way of trying to define the critical processes in the Earth system that some of which may have tipping points, not all of them, but that we need to respect where boundaries might lie. That if we stay within the so-called safe operating space, then we're unlikely to push the system over into the hothouse Earth trajectory. So this is a sort of fork in the road, or the technical term, bifurcation of the pathways.
Yes. Yes, yes. I spoke to Kate a while ago for the podcast, and I think it's very, very interesting. It ties together really important ideas, and I know she's just released a city-based donut for Amsterdam, which looks very interesting and ties together those questions, as you say, the environmental limits and the kind of social values that we would want to have as well. And I think it's a very powerful way of looking at it. There seems to have been, and I don't know whether you'd agree with this, but an approach in maybe not just the scientific community, but an idea that if only we could explain what was going on better, if the scientists were better, if we could talk about this in a clearer way, then people would get the message, and you know, we would see massive change. And I think I just wonder to what degree you think that has been the case is a good way of looking at it. And it does seem to be that we've started to see, and Naomi Klein was talking about this kind of climate nationalism, climate fascism, and so forth. So the debate in certain, well, not necessarily the debate, but the way the question's been framed, been moved from one of whether it's happening or not to, well, yeah, maybe it's happening, but actually these are the kind of changes we need to do to actually deal with this, which might be to, you know, close borders and get involved in a more nationalistic and you know, arguably more fascistic kind of approach. So I'm just wondering about what you think about that idea and about the communication and how the, I guess, because people have become very much aware, more aware of what's going on in the environment, certainly even in the last 6 months to a year, there's been quite a sea change.
Yeah, no, look, I think that's important. And I think getting authoritative scientific information there about the nature of the risks is important. I think it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. I think we need more than just the science. And I think we see this with the COVID-19 crisis, again, where you see science playing an extremely strong role in terms of the medical sciences, the epidemiology, the infectious disease people, and so on, who are really in the driver's seat in terms of giving advice on what needs to be done. And it's more or less being heeded in most places around the world, no matter what style of government was in place when this crisis hit. But then once we know what we need to do to solve this COVID-19 crisis, then there are all sorts of social actions, social innovations, and so on, which are helping us adapt to the life we have to have if we want to stop this pandemic. In a way, the science is definitely really important and it's necessary, but it's not sufficient in terms of just getting us through. And the same with climate change. And climate change does have some characteristics of COVID-19. One is it has the potential to have disastrous consequences for humanity. Second of all, to really solve this, you do have to have science, and you need to listen to the science, which tells you the nature of the problem, how the system is behaving, and what we need to do to stabilize the system. Third thing, which is really important, is to really avoid a crisis, you have to act before it gets really bad. And that's been made really clear in the COVID-19 crisis, that you want to flatten the curve before it peaks. You don't want to let it peak. We haven't got to that point yet in the climate change issue, and that's some of that timing we were talking about earlier, that to avoid the Titanic hitting the ice, you actually have to stop it or turn it well in advance of getting close to the iceberg. And we haven't got to that point yet on climate change. I think one of the big changes now, though, is that a lot of the technologies we need to solve the climate change issue are really coming on stream faster than we thought. They're certainly becoming economically viable and so on, which takes away one big constraint. So now we're dealing more with politics and vested interests. And there, I think, the social tipping point idea is a really important one. And that's our hope that we can act with speed. Tipping points can happen fast. Social tipping points can happen fast. And they can surprise even the experts on that when they look back and say, why didn't we see this coming? So I think that's what gives one hope, is that the action that's building in many parts of the world may be enough within the next few years to tip the scales on the climate change issue.
Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. Earth system science, can you just maybe, going back to that, talk a little bit about that and where we are, or where Earth system science is, as it were? It seems that the Earth systems must be complex by many orders of magnitude than other systems that we're used to looking at, or that, I mean, I guess that the whole area of systems thinking itself and is less developed maybe than our more linear approaches to so forth. Can you maybe just talk about what you think is interesting that's going on at the moment in this area, and that might feed into how we think about and deal with the climate crisis?
Yeah, well, first of all, of course, the term Earth system science is in the singular. System is a singular. So we're looking at the Earth as one system, and that originates from a guy called Vladimir Vernadsky back in the 1920s, who was talking about how the biosphere and the geosphere interacted to form one system. And of course, famously, James Lovelock, with his Gaia hypothesis, was also one of the key people in the evolution of Earth system science. But the point there is that all this complexity underneath the level of the Earth system, a lot of that dampens out. And so what you have to do look at what are the key factors that can either stabilize or disrupt or destabilize or transform the Earth system, singular, as a whole. So you look at the planetary system as a single system. And then you look at what are the important processes, atmospheric ocean circulation, the biosphere, the carbon cycle, the nutrient cycles, nitrogen, phosphorus, and others, and so on. And you look at the energy exchange between various parts of the system, and so on. So you can take a top-down view and say, what are the few things we really need to know to understand how the system operates? And then you can start to see where are the critical points at which one can intervene in this system. So the tipping point idea is a classic one here, because in complex system theory, one way of looking at systems, complex systems, is that they exist in well-defined states, and they undergo transitions between these states, oftentimes in a highly nonlinear way. So this gets you away from the simple cause-effect logic, which dominates still a lot of the natural sciences, so that in a complex system way, you can push the system and prod the system and disrupt the system to a point. And it looks very stable. So you think, well, this is a great system. We can get away with anything, until you start crossing those tipping points. And then you can see a trajectory of the system away to another state. When you look at the key handful of tipping points in the Earth system and look at their linkages, that's when you get to this idea of a tipping cascade, or a point of no return in the Earth system. And when you look at the long geological past, you can see complex system behavior at various points in the Earth system. You can see long gradual change. You can see abrupt changes. You can see an oscillatory behavior, as we have in about the last 1.2 million years. So you can see very, very many features of complex system dynamics in the way the Earth system has behaved. So this is a different paradigm, a different framework than the classical scientific reductionist framework, which is to take a piece of the Earth system out of its context and study it in great detail, holding everything else constant. But then you lose the dynamics of how the system actually operates. So I think it's useful to have the classical way of doing science, but we need to complement that with complex systems theory and modeling to understand much better how the Earth system might behave.
Yeah, very interesting. And where is that now? What's next for you, Will, in terms of your research and what you're doing?
All right. Well, I think now we're trying to get a bigger handle on this idea of social tipping points. I'm really enjoying working with social scientists and humanities scholars who can really start elucidating all the intricate details of what the anthroposphere actually looks like. And very importantly, not to view it as a monolithic humanity as a whole sort of thing, but to look at the various knowledge systems and ways we can look at the Earth. One of my colleagues likes to describe this as a democracy of voices in terms of how we look at and deal with the Earth system, which is very important. And I guess for me, sitting here in Australia, one of the voices that I'm really trying to learn more about are the indigenous peoples around the planet. We are in a good situation here in Australia. We have the oldest continuous civilization on in Earth history. And that's, of course, the indigenous Australians who have been here for about 60 to 65,000 years. And they have some very interesting ways of thinking, different ways of thinking about the role of humanity in the Earth system. And very importantly, they do have a system level understanding of the environment around them and of the planet as a whole. So that's where I'm sort of taking myself, was trying to get out of my natural scientist skin for a little bit and try to learn more from my colleagues in the natural sciences and the social sciences and the humanities.
Well, I wish you the very best with all that, Will, and thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your research, your ideas. They're very interesting and very powerful, and thank you for that.
My pleasure. Thank you, Fergal.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.